everyone. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm your host, Megan Henry. And today I am joined by Jeff Moshinsky. Jeff is a fellow attorney. He has a really interesting background. Right now, he opened his own firm about 2 years ago. But prior to that, he worked for several years as a plaintiff's attorney. And before that, he worked several years as a defense attorney. So he's kind of sees things from all different angles. And now he has a mixed practice and even has a mediation practice. So he really gets to see all sides of the coin. And I thought it'd be really great to bring him in and give some advice to what he sees on the defense side, the plaintiff side, and mediation side, and his perspective from opening his own firm. So with that, let's bring him in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.
Good afternoon, Jeff. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Megan.
I'm so happy to have you come on. You and I had talked a few weeks ago at length because we kind of just shared a similar background. We're both practicing attorneys and have families and we have kids kind of around the same age. And you and I just kind of hit it off. And I thought it'd be great to have you come on because you've had such an interesting career and you recently launched a new firm. Well, not that recently, but in the last 2 years. So I thought it'd be really great to have you come on.
Well, I'm really glad to be here. I think we initially connected probably through LinkedIn or something like that. Many of these things happen. And yeah, just a great connection. And I'm excited to be here and share whatever I can and be helpful for sure.
This is something I talk to everyone I have on this podcast about because we all have different paths on how we got where we are. And you're an attorney. Did you always think that you were going to go to law school? Like, were your parents lawyers or other family members lawyers? Or is it something you kind of fell into?
I definitely fell into it. So I was a kid that all through high school and undergrad, everyone said you were going to be a lawyer. And being the person I was, at least at that point, I said, no way, never going to be a lawyer. So I was a high school teacher originally and did that for about 5 years and found myself kind of in between some teaching jobs and came back to school to get some more, like renew my licensure, and had a professor there that said, you know, you should really think about law school. And it was the right time, the right kind of opportunity. And I said, you know, I don't have a full-time job yet for the fall. I'm going to apply for law school. And the more I went through that process, the more I got excited about it. And apparently everybody that talked to me in the past was right. I guess I should have been a lawyer. So that's how I kind of ended up making that transition, I guess. Yeah.
So much like yourself, much like myself, I took some time in between when I graduated college and going to law school. And so how did you find that experience in going to law school a little bit older, a little bit wiser than some of your classmates? Did you find you may have approached the whole experience in a different view than some of your classmates may have?
Yeah, it was an interesting experience for me. So I was, 29, 28, something like that when I started law school. I got engaged the year before. We were planning a wedding for my second year. So I was definitely in a different place than the 24, 23-year-olds who were going to they were de-stressing on weekends and evenings more than I was. I had the benefit of going to a law school in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, where it was kind of founded on the idea of second career lawyers. And so they had a nights and evenings program, or at least more classes available. And that was a big part of why I chose them. I looked around at a lot of different places, but it was, I couldn't be in a classroom with 24, 25-year-old people. They were brilliant and smart, and it was just a different perspective. So yeah, there were more of people like me, but then also I was some flexibility. So when actually I had a kid during the summer between our second and third year, I was able to switch all my classes to evenings. And I was a stay-at-home dad for my son and then went to classes and did all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it worked out really well.
But that also still must have been pretty hard to juggle, having a newborn or a young child at home and juggling the reading and the studying. And I didn't have any kids when I was in law school, but I would imagine it's a lot to handle. I had classmates that did. And I remember looking at them being like, how are they doing this?
Yeah. You know, there were a few of us that all kind of grouped ourselves together, some older folks, and one of them had a kid, and we would help out. We'd all kind of pitch in. We became kind of a family, but it was hard. My wife and I now, so we're, my son is a senior in high school, and my daughter is a freshman. We're now transitioning to the other side of that and realizing that this is going to be the first time in our lives we haven't had to juggle all of those things all at the same time. And what does that look like for our jobs, for life, for having fun, all those sorts of things.
Yeah. So
yeah. It's, yeah, it's different. It's different.
But I imagine that when you graduate, well, actually, when you graduated, did you have a job lined up? Or because you and I graduated around the same time, and I remember it being a very difficult job market at that time. So like, yes. I did not have a job lined up.
So. Yeah. So I had kind of, I'll jokingly refer to it as the worst of all worlds. So I actually had an OCI summer job and did that. Got extended an offer, firm I loved. That was my first choice. The people there are still my best friends. But as I graduated in May then of 2007, I helped them pack up the office of three floors and 100 attorneys. They had been together for 50 or so years at that point, and the firm dissolved. So my job dissolved with it, and I ended up clerking for the Court of Appeals in Minnesota for a year, which was exciting, super experience. But as you may remember, and many listeners may remember, 2007, 2008 was not a great time to enter into the legal market. So that was hard. All the clerks were like, where did our jobs go? I had friends that were clerks that had jobs get pulled, and other people, we just all had a hard time. So I had a family. We actually decided to have our second during that process. So it was a take the job you can get. Yep. Start learning, hit the ground running. Thankfully, I had a good network of people. So I took a job as an insurance defense attorney right after clerking. And yeah, I got my feet wet as a litigator then at that point.
I had like a similar experience. The firm that I summered at, there was two of us who did like the summer internship or whatever, and they mm-hmm. couldn't extend mm-hmm. either of us offers at the time. And then later they got gobbled up by another firm. So during the time I was so disappointed because mm-hmm. I had loved that firm. I had spent the summer there. I was like, this is right. the path you're supposed to take. You get the job after the summer thing. And it didn't work out. But then when I was looking back at it, I'm like, well, I probably would have been the first one to get let go when they got gobbled up by that other firm. But at the same time, taking that whole, the turn of like, oh, now I need to start from square one again. And then the job market was just terrible.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a humbling experience, to say the least.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I remember being really nervous, really scared. And then when the job finally comes through, you know, because I had plenty of interviews during that time and they all were like, yeah, we'd love to give you a job, but we don't have a space. So yeah, it was humbling. It was very humbling. And, you know, it's funny, the firm that I had been scheduled to go to, my judge was a partner there at one point. Most of my best friends in the field were actually there. We still have that firm, still has holiday in the wintertime and summer parties mm-hmm. with alumni. So we get together and it's probably 50, 60 people each time that are getting together. So it was a place that was really wonderful, but sadly didn't make it. So,
Yeah. It's nice that they still do that, though. That is nice. And there is something to be said about those relationships that you forge at the beginning. Like, I still have two of my closest friends are from not necessarily that summer internship, but that first job that I had that I was mm-hmm. there for several years. You know, I still talk to some of my fellow colleagues, I should say, very frequently. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's a real friendship that, you know, came out of professional environment, which I love.
Yeah. We're all, if you're litigators, not litigators, whatever, we're all advocating for our clients, things like that. And these people that you can actually open up with, be transparent with, have a shared history with, go through kind of struggles of young lawyers and experienced lawyers and running things. It's nice to have those people on those days, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember even like getting an assignment from one of the partners. I think it was like responding to interrogatories. She was like, oh, you know, respond to these interrogatories. And I was like, I don't know how to do this. And I like went over to one of those people and I was like, what am I supposed to do? And she had 3 more years experience than I did. But when she looked at it, she's like, oh, you object to this one. I'm like, how do you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yep. Yeah, the difference between that first year associate and that third year associate is like the difference between, you know, a lifetime and a newborn. Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah. I was like, I'll never be as good as her.
Yeah, I remember those feelings.
So you were in the defense world for some time and then more recently made a change. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about that. Like, what was the influence in changing your path?
Sure. It was like any job change. There were a lot of factors that went into it. Some were personal, some were fit, some were culture of different jobs I had had. I had been a defense attorney for 7 years. So a little less now than half of my career. And at that point, I had first chaired, I think, 2 trials, maybe, and second chaired a bunch of others and was doing some appellate work. But I really wanted to get in the courtroom more and do more trial work. And so it seemed like a natural fit for me to switch over to the plaintiff's side, where I knew I'd get more trial work. And in fact, I did. So, you know, you mentioned earlier, I started my own firm about 2 years ago. So in the 9 years or so I've been doing plaintiff's work, I think I've had somewhere between 30 and 35 trials compared to the 2, right, that I would chalk up as first chair as a defense attorney. So that was a big part of it. And I think I always had a kind of a personal piece to the plaintiff side where maybe I don't want to say I was more sympathetic to it, but I think it needed a different approach. I saw a lot of otherwise skilled plaintiff's attorneys who were clearly doing things because they thought they knew what was best. And I thought there was an underserved market there for a plaintiff's attorney who wanted to come in and say, what do you want? What do you need?
Yeah.
And it just felt like the right fit. So yeah. And then I made the jump and loved it. And of course, now that I have my own firm, I'm kind of doing a little bit of a lot of different things. So, yeah.
So tell me though about that, the transition though, because I've talked to a lot of people that started off as defense attorneys and then straddle over to the other side, so to speak. But at first, was it a challenge for you to kind of change your mindset and how you looked at things, or did it just come easily to you because of what you just said that you kind of gravitated towards that anyway?
I think it took time. I think part of it I was able to jump into right away, the more human side of it. Not that defense attorneys don't see the humanity of it, but it's a different approach, right? Or at least I always saw it as a defense attorney's job is to know everything and anything about the file and to know where the holes were and to know where the flaws were and to be able to argue and use those things. But you were more of a detail person, right? You needed to pick apart the details. And the plaintiff's job was to tell the big picture and the broad strokes and evoke the feelings and things like that. And I had a hard time with that. I still think I have a hard time with that. I think my brain likes the detail, likes the nuance, likes the drilling down all the information. I've co-counseled with other plaintiff's attorneys and watching some of them do the big, broad, sweeping stroke statements is amazing to watch because it's not.
Yeah.
It's just not who I am. When I made that transition initially, I had a really hard time like not spending too much time on files. As funny as that sounds, right? The plaintiff's practice is in many ways built on volume just because of the risk. So you got to run more files. You got to have more files. You got to do the task that's in front of you, move it forward. Do the task in front of you, move it forward. You don't necessarily have the time to spend hours upon hours upon hours mastering everything that's in that file because you need to. And that I remember some of my partners then spending some time, Jeff, you can't dig that deep in this thing. You can't go down that rabbit hole right now. It's not an issue for right now. We need to move that forward. And so that was a struggle for me and figuring out how to match what I felt comfortable with just a different approach. It just felt like a very different approach. Yeah.
So since you were started off on the defense side and then you move over to the plaintiff's mm-hmm. side, you know, what advice do you give to fellow defense attorneys in forging the relationships with counsel or just with what you've noticed that helps move the file along that sometimes maybe you see things that defense attorneys do that really put a monkey wrench into the whole process that's unnecessary? Mm. You know what I mean?
Sure. So I think if I were to say to a defense attorney from a plaintiff's perspective, is to pay more attention to the plaintiff themselves, mm-hmm. to listen to the plaintiff, to hear the plaintiff, to really focus on the plaintiff. I remember countless times as a defense attorney saying to any claims person, look, the value of the case is X before I've taken the deposition. Once I take the deposition of the plaintiff, it changes. It goes up, it goes down, but it changes because that plaintiff is typically the most, in my eyes, at least the most important driver of what I think might happen with that case. If the jury loves the plaintiff, won't like the plaintiff, if they're not believable, if they're super credible, sympathetic. And I see a lot of defense attorneys focus on their case without looking at the story that the plaintiff's going to tell, right? And the presentation that the plaintiff is going to make. In many instances, some of the best plaintiff's attorneys I find set the stage for the plaintiff to go tell their story, right? They're putting on that show for that jury. And I think many defense attorneys, not many, I think there are defense attorneys where it slows down this process in the evaluation of getting together, that they're looking still at the facts and the arguments and not the presentation and the feelings side of it, right?
Yeah.
I know there's these inconsistencies in these three records, but did you listen to the way that that person explained how they were feeling?
Yeah.
That's much more compelling, and you're going to lose the jury. Those three different records are not going to make sense, but the really compelling, lovable mom of four who just wants to take care of their kids is probably going to win that day. So I think that's the biggest thing I see, is just missing the humanity of a case.
Of course, there are those times you don't have that type of plaintiff.
Totally. Oh, totally true. Yes. And I would say that to plaintiff's attorneys, you know, because I mediate a fair number of cases. I would say that to plaintiff's attorneys, just because this one looks like on paper the other one where you got a great verdict doesn't mean that plaintiff is the same, right? Mm-hmm. And doesn't mean that you'll have the same jury and doesn't mean that they'll tell the story the same way. You know, I have a very good friend who says to me whenever we talk about trials or whatever afterwards, he's like, look, we're never as good and important as we think we are when we win. And we're never as bad or as stupid as we think we are when we lose. We're doing as best we can as any trial attorney, defense or plaintiff side. But those facts, those witnesses, the way that they present makes so much more of a difference. And a bad plaintiff is going to tank any otherwise good case. Yeah.
And to just jump off of that, though, too, or jump off of the advice you give to defense attorneys, obviously, a lot of people who listen to this podcast are in claims. And your first people you are probably talking to as a plaintiff's attorney is the claims adjuster. What sort of advice do you give to them in those early stages of when they receive a claim and they get a letter of representation, how to navigate those waters? So, you know, maybe the case avoids suit. But of course,
sure,
we don't want to overpay just to avoid suit. So, you know, what kind of advice do you give to them?
Well, I think first off, be open to open conversation, right? I understand that claims has a job to do, and so does the plaintiff's attorney have a job to do. But the more that we can be open with each other and have that conversation of, look, this is the way I see the case. And they can say, look, this is the way I see the case. And we can make a decision early on then. Look, we're not on the same page. We don't see things the same way. And then we can adjust. Maybe they need more information that I can give them to help them see it my way. Or maybe it's just not going to happen and we need to litigate that case. Or maybe the two of us have some really good conversations and we say, you know what, I see where you're coming from. Maybe there's somewhere here that we can reach an understanding as opposed to arguing about it. I think one thing I've had really good success with when the claims person is open to it is that human side. Again, the claims person is just seeing the paper, right? They're getting the photos, diagrams, reports, medical records, whatever it might be, but they're not seeing the person. And they don't, sometimes they'll have a conversation with the person, but that person's typically scared, not sure what's going on. They're probably not doing the best that they can. And then the claims person can make a judgment about that person. What I recommend is, especially digital age that we have right here, take a video of your person. If the claims adjuster is willing to, the claims person is willing to look at it, get to know that person, or set up a Zoom meeting, right? So that they can see that person and say, hey, this is who this person is. This is how they're going to present. You hire an attorney out. This is what they're going to tell you about this person. Take a look at this person and tell me what your thoughts are, because this is what I see. Sometimes claims people are really open to that. Other times, no, I don't know that I have the answer for why it is and why it isn't.
Right.
But I would say as a claims person, get as much information as you can before you make a decision about what that case might be worth. And I understand, I did it for enough years. I understand what reserves are and how the underwriting and all that sort of stuff, actuarial people come in and they assign certain values to cases and what you have to do to change the values of those cases. So I understand all that. But I would say be hungry for more information rather than make a conclusion and then stick to that conclusion as if you are adversaries with the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney. I know we technically are, but if you really want to get at what is the value of this case, you should be hungry for as much information as possible and want it from me. And hopefully if we have a good relationship, or if anybody has a good relationship with you, any plaintiff's attorney, I'll give you everything I have, right? I'll give you the stuff that I think you need to evaluate your case. And hopefully, you know, people aren't hiding things from you or whatever.
I think that's great advice. So especially the getting them on video or just a call, just so I can see a plaintiff being hesitant for that as well. I hear the value in that just because it can mean a lot more to talk to someone or see someone versus the representations you're getting on paper or on the phone with even the attorney. Be like, well, she's a really nice lady. She's going to present well. Well, how are they supposed to really know?
Yeah. And, you know, do I ever have difficulties with claims people about what the medical bills are or anything like that? Sometimes, but not that often. When it's at the margins, the challenges are, how does this affect this person? The pain and suffering, the non-economic damages, the disability, whatever. And that only comes through when you actually talk to the person, see the person. As much as we do this and we all evaluate cases and we all come up with what the value is, the difference in all of these cases is those, this person, it's a little different here. And this person, it's a little different there. I guess that's the primary thing I suggest.
I think that's great advice. And I honestly, I've never heard it and I don't see it that much. So I actually would encourage any claims professional listening to this that think about it, because I think that could help move cases off their pending claims, because maybe you have a case that is just, you have a really good plaintiff and the damages and it's like, hey, you know what? Maybe we can avoid suit in this one after taking some smaller steps that aren't overly that hard, really. Slightly unorthodox, like not typical, but just because it's not typical doesn't mean it's not a good idea and it shouldn't happen. So,
And I've done it even with early mediation, pre-suit mediation, where I'm sending those videos to the mediator and to the claims people, but I'm sending them saying, look, these are who my plaintiffs are. I want you to see them as we're evaluating what this case is like. And it takes some work. From a plaintiff's side, it takes work and you want to practice it and all this sort of stuff. You don't want to just throw it up there and hope for the best. I don't know, Megan, you tell me on the defense side, I don't know if a claims person would be skeptical, right, of a recorded video versus a live video. And I'd say certainly there's edited versions of those things. But sometimes the unedited versions of the videos are honestly the best because the plaintiff feels more comfortable. And you can see that it's unedited, right? You can just see them being themselves. So do you think that claims people would look at it differently if it were live versus recorded?
I've definitely seen some of the recorded day in the life type videos.
Sure.
Those, I think sometimes they're there's definitely a story being told in those. And I think sometimes they do have some skepticism attached to them, but I do think they serve a purpose too. And they tell a story. I think the real value would be just from a call, just a Zoom call or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I can see the flip side, how there could be some hesitation with that as well. Mm-hmm. But you take each case as it comes and be like, maybe this is one that's worth sitting down and talking to Mrs. Smith about her injuries.
Yep. You know, the other way to approach it, and this would be what a video would look like, but you can do it live, and I've done it this way, is I'll conduct kind of a deposition of my own client on video, right? So they're feeling more comfortable because I'm asking the questions, and then they tell more information, right? It's not scripted per se, but it's not recorded, right? The claims person gets to see it live, or the attorney gets to see it live. And then I usually at the end say, okay, claims person, attorney, do you have any questions that I haven't covered, right? And give them that opportunity to then jump in. And then it's a little more controlled. It's a little safer from the plaintiff's perspective, but it's still a live, like you say, it's not a pre-produced movie.
obviously those movies are made to invoke sympathy. And I mean, they can be very compelling.
Yes. But, and they have purpose. They certainly have a purpose in the right case. Yes. But not all cases.
Tell me more about the where you are now, because you worked primarily as a plaintiff's attorney for some time, and then now recently opened up your own shop. You're doing mediation, you're doing cases. You're like, tell me how you came to that decision and doing what you're doing now.
For me, it was always about how do I want to practice and what were my kind of core values. I think there's a whole lot of different ways to practice law. I think there's a whole lot of different ways to practice plaintiff's law or civil litigation on either side. For me, I knew I wanted my primary focus to be the client. I know this sounds like trite. All the people putting on their websites, we're client focused, we're client centered, whatever the buzz term is. But I really feel like the best way to practice for me is I'm going to tell the client what all their options are, what the risks, what the benefits are, give them my advice, and then let them make the choice. And if I think they're making a wrong choice, I might say it, but I'm going to still do 110% of my best for them. And similarly, I'm not going to advocate for a choice that I think might be good for me or my business or my reputation or my skills if I don't think it's the right choice for them.
Yeah.
So I started my own firm to really kind of live those values, right? And to have, I think, more honest conversations with my clients. I mean, selfishly, as you know, dealing with partners is a wonderful thing. And it's also a tricky thing, right? You constantly are thinking about what are my partners going to think about this approach or that approach, or if I say this, or you're not only representing you, you're representing everybody all the time. And so selfishly, I think, right or wrong, wanted to just kind of do it myself, right? And take it on myself. So now what I do is I have a solo firm. I have a remote staff member and I do mostly plaintiff's work, but I do civil defense work. So I do a lot of all those insurance defense friends that I have when they have those coverage cases where there isn't coverage or there's questions about excess coverage or uncovered claims or whatever, they send them to me and I do the defense work for them because I'm not really conflicted with the insurers. I do coverage work, just straight coverage work for people on both sides of the aisle. And then, like you said, I do mediation work. It's been described to me that I can speak adjuster and speak plaintiff, which I think are very different languages. Yes. And so I try to use that to help people better resolve their disputes. And I like that. I really enjoy that. That's probably what I enjoy most at this point in my career is helping people try to settle cases. Yeah. I'll still fight the fights and still try the cases, but I really like the mediation work.
How was it when you first started out, though? I imagine it's a learning process and you're starting out not knowing a whole lot of how to open an office.
And it's terrifying. It's still terrifying. I would say there's probably isn't a day that I'm not thinking about what else should I be doing or could I be doing. It's a lot to it. I think there's plenty of podcasts that go through how to start a law firm and things like that. I won't reinvent the wheel on them. Well, the story I tell, I have a good friend who is an insurance defense attorney, and he called me up about 3 months into the practice and just said, "Hey, Jeff, how are you doing today? What's today like?" Right? Just checking in. Super nice. And I told him, well, I've just spent half the day trying to figure out how to print an envelope successfully. And I still can't figure it out. So that's been my day. And it's starting your own firm is a lot of that, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you have massive resources where you can delegate out to all the people that are smarter than you at all the things that you used to have staff members for, you really have to figure everything out. You have to, I was talking with another solo attorney just this morning. If you don't like putting stamps on envelopes, if you don't like going down to the mailbox, if you can't handle looking up somebody's address, then you probably shouldn't be a solo. Then you should go somewhere where you have staff to do some of those things. And that doesn't mean that people at big firms with staff aren't self-sufficient. Of course they are.
Right.
But there's just a lot of, there's so many other hats. You know, I do some of my accounting stuff. I have a bookkeeper and accountant, but I financially planning things and I'm managing files and figuring out where to store things and what are my ethical obligations and managing your trust account and all those things that go into the business of law. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff online about law school doesn't prepare us to run a business, really. And I think I've never thought that was more true than when I started my own.
Right. And why? And I don't understand why not. like, why isn't there something, like, I'm going to rant for a minute, so bear with me, but there's two things I think are missing.
I agree with
you,
I'm sure.
Two major things. Yeah. How to actually be a lawyer, how to actually practice, and how to run a business, because it's huge. Yes, there's plenty of people who go to law school and never open or run a firm, but for the amount of people that there aren't, there are many who are. And there's another thing that you don't teach you. Is like the other part of running a business as an attorney is how to go about marketing, how to get business, how important that piece is to the whole process. And it's just not taught. And some of that, yes, you cannot teach. You cannot teach in a classroom setting, but there has to be a way that there should be some sort of aspect of that woven through. I think some of the schools catch it with some of the schools that do like the co-op programs. The students can learn how to be an attorney and be a practicing attorney through the duration of law school. There's clinics that helps you too, but it doesn't totally do the job though. And especially doesn't teach you how to run an office and how the business side of it.
Oh yeah. And I'll get on my rant at this point. I've been in enough firms, and no knock on anybody I've ever worked for or worked with, but the skills that make you a good lawyer, particularly a litigator, do not also translate to management of people and offices. And that doesn't mean that they can't coexist, but the single-minded focus of a litigator and kind of the narrow window of looking at that one particular case and mastering it and then forgetting all about it, right? And moving on to the next one, if it's trial or whatever it is, those things are just, I think, challenging for us as attorneys. And you're right. It's drilled into our heads in law school how to suck up information and spit it back out at a moment's notice. Not so much with the listening to human concerns and navigating intrapersonal conflicts and forecasting budgets or hiring somebody without jeopardizing your whole firm because you asked the wrong question in the hiring process, or how to fire someone, or how to do a corrective action with somebody. You know, not every firm can have an HR professional or has an employment law practice. So here we are doing whatever and thinking that we can figure it out. It's hard. I am a complete advocate for is it post-law school for the people that want it, offering clinics and things like that, or if it's third year classes where it's like, look, at this point, you might know that you might end up at least in a smaller to solo practice. It might be good to have some management skills. Yeah, I couldn't advocate for that enough. I think it would make all of the difference in the field.
What I think part of the challenge with it too is, and maybe this is why law schools don't have it, is because when you're in it, like when you're in law school, you might not have the forethought of that's going to be down the road for you. I know I wasn't thinking that.
No. Yeah,
I didn't even think I was going to be in litigation. I wanted to go be a real estate attorney, you know?
Oh, really? Oops. Yep.
Yeah, but it graduated 2007. There was no real estate attorney hiring going on. Like,
that's true. Yeah, nobody was buying anything. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So I had to pivot, but I wasn't thinking about that. I mean, the closest I got was taking accounting for lawyers, which most of the other people in my class who took that class thought it was the worst class imaginable because they're like, oh, we have to do accounting. And I wasn't great at it, but I was a math major, but math and accounting are very different. My husband's an accountant. We always talk about math and accounting is just different, but it didn't intimidate me as much.
Agreed.
My classmates, some of them were like, if you told them to go take a whole class in Japanese, like it was just such a foreign concept.
I think it's weird, but I have that same experience. I can muddle through my Excel spreadsheets and my QuickBooks and talk to my accountant and things like that. But there is a heightened level of anxiety with those numbers. And I think so much of us litigators or attorneys, we straddle that perfectionism line, and those numbers don't lie to you, right? It's easy to miss a typo in a brief or miss a date, something like that. We make mistakes. We're all humans. But that Excel spreadsheet, when it's wrong, when you transpose the number and now you've got to figure out how to fix that problem and where it went, it's just staring you in the face. There's something unforgiving about that. Yeah, for sure. So 100%, we'll start a law school together and we'll make it all about how to practice law instead of just spot issues and write blue book essays.
I just feel like there should be a class called like the business of law, And maybe like all my classmates who got their MBA at the same time, maybe that's what they were all doing. But I think they were going for something different than just running a firm. I think they had a different agenda. I just think that class or some sort of class like that would be helpful. I look back to, I think about my first year learning civil procedure. And at the time, civil procedure seemed to be, to me, it was the most complicated, convoluted subject matter imaginable. Sure. And then in practice, I'm like, why did I think this was so hard? Like, it's literally just following the rules. But the class for civil procedure made it seem hard. And I think the way it could have been easier is it just learning how to practically apply the rules, which at least in my civil procedure class, I don't think I ever learned how to practically apply the rules. It was just, oh, this is where this rule came from, this old case from 1700 or wherever they are from.
Very classical way to teach that. You know, I think, well, and some of that, is that a function of our law school professors are largely law school academic professors, right? That so many of them haven't practiced, or if they practiced, they practiced in New York or Boston or big firms and haven't had to really dig into the meat and bones of what it takes to make day-to-day. They've just been able to practice then, right? Spot issues, write briefs, make arguments, take testimony or draft agreements or whatever it is. No knock on that, but yeah, there's a real shortage of real applicable training for young lawyers. For sure.
And then going with that, how you talked about the interpersonal skills required to start and run an office. Talk about like going 0 to 60. You have to be able to wear a bunch of different hats. And I have a similar challenge because it's like, oh, well, you know, you have to come in, you have to bill your hours, you have to make the money come in because that's how the office is going to stay afloat. But then you have this whole other counterpiece that is is time that you need to utilize and spend to run your office that is not accounted for on that sheet that pays the bill.
It's totally true. That was honestly the biggest, I think, challenge I had as a young associate was trying to balance those things, right? How do I build a network? How do I get to know how to do things? How do I write articles? How do I get my name out there and still meet my billable targets and make money and look good for the firm and all those sorts of things? It's such a struggle. And yeah, there's nobody at, I don't want to say nobody. It's hard to find mentors, I think, in this field that are working, that also want to mentor you in those interpersonal ways. You can learn a lot from the really good ones and watch them, and you can learn a lot from the not so good ones and watch what not to do. But so much of your time is taken up practicing law, unless you have a dedicated office attorney, somebody who's not really expected to litigate or generate as much. Yeah, I don't know where you learn from other than just osmosis and guess and be okay with failing miserably over and over again. Have a good heart, right? That's maybe we should develop in the law school entrance exams how to figure out if somebody has a good heart so they could be a good office managing attorney someday.
I know. Yeah. It's just so hard to encompass all the roles. Like I always think about it too. Like I would love to teach you how to practice. I would also love to teach you how to market. I'd love to teach you how to do this, all while like pulling the things that I learned along the way from my mentors. But I didn't learn one thing from one person. I learned a lot of things from a lot of different people. Some had a much larger mentor role than others, but you certainly learn those things along the way. But then I also think about for myself, it took me a long time to open up to the networking part. Like I wasn't doing a lot of the networking that first 5 years. I felt like it was just learning how to be a lawyer. And I think that's okay. But I wish I had done or put some more emphasis on the networking part early on than waiting, just because it takes some time to catch up.
It does. Yeah. You know, I think I got lucky. I'm really extroverted to the point that it drives my wife nuts sometimes. It drives my kid. They laugh all the time. Like, oh, there's dad talking to somebody else in the elevator again. Chat up, whoever. And so I don't think I realized I was networking, going to a conference or at a deposition. And I'm just going to chat with whomever is there. And I want to know, tell me about your family. How about your kids? What do you do? What's for fun? You know, what's for dinner tonight? I don't know anything. I just want to talk to you. I had a person that I observed do that at my first firm and saw just the way kind of he lit up a room. And I would never claim to be that person. But I think young attorneys don't have to network in the deliberate way that maybe you and I do at this point in our career, if they are deliberately just having conversations with people that aren't work related, right? Have it at a work thing, go to that deposition, but then talk to somebody about something you might have in common. Go to the conference, but then just make sure you go to the happy hour and just have some communication about the sports team or the book you read or the movie you saw or whatever. The more you get to know people as humans and less as lawyers, I think the better that networking becomes.
100% It goes across the board. Like having a genuine organic interest in the other person, it speaks huge volumes versus having like a kind of a pretend interest, you know, or only trying to talk about work stuff. Like, I don't know, like we all work so much that we don't want to always talk about work. You want to, you know, when people want to talk about like their kids or the game or Taylor Swift, whatever it is, like people want to talk about
anything. Yes. Yep. Although I'm really not up to speed on TikTok or Reels, Instagram Reels. So I can't keep up with it. Can you? Yeah. My daughter can give me I'm the typical dad that the kids make fun of. Dad, what are you doing?
I mean, totally side note. I like said to my kids, I think we need to like pull back on TikTok. And it was as if I was like, hey, can you hand me your left arm? Because they were like, are you kidding? Yeah. We're not going to know anything. I was like, well, I think you'll be okay. Like, just let's pull it in. Like, we don't need to be spending as much time on this app.
Maybe we can pare that down a little bit. Yeah. I don't need to see hours upon hours with teenagers.
And you know what happens when you limit their time? They find something else to do. Imagine that.
Very true. Yes.
Like what is next for you? Like, you know, you're doing all the planning, the business planning, the forecasting. Like, do you have ideas or plans as to where you're taking your firm next?
I am really at a decision-making point, I guess. I'm busy enough now that I get to make some decisions, which is such a luxury to have. The goal is to build the mediation practice and actually bring in somebody that, you know, we were talking about mentoring and things like that. I'd love to bring in somebody to do more of the litigating work and have me focus on the mediation and then let them learn by doing. I mean, that's how you learn in this practice, but have that safety net of, you have somebody who's been doing it for long enough. And really, I really want to train somebody, right? And have them grow their practice. I think that's exciting. Maybe it's the teacher in me still, but wanting that kind of mentorship aspect. So that's probably what's next once I make the decision that it's time to make that leap and hire somebody and grow the practice, right? I don't want to be big. I never want to be like big. But a couple attorneys someday might not be a bad approach.
A few people to bounce some ideas off of.
This extrovert is lonely sometimes when it comes to just sitting in an office by himself or talking to his remote staff member. It's I go home and the kids are like, stop talking to us. Like, you can't just talk to us. You need to meet somebody for lunch or something. Just don't talk to somebody else.
I am curious. So how did you come up with the name? Because it's not your last name, so which is the typical way to go.
Yeah, so for those of you that either heard it or see it on the screen or whatever, my last name is long and Polish and hard to pronounce. And so I debated long and hard about whether I should use Mashinsky Law or I should try something different. Like most of the things in my life, my wife had the better idea, which was to try and build it around the practice idea. And so Lagom, L-A-G-O-M, is a Swedish term. And the Swedish term is used to describe something that's not too much, not too little, but just the right amount of whatever it is. So your coffee can be Lagom because it's not too hot, not too cold. And similarly, I like to think that my practice is that way. I'm not too aggressive, but I'm also not going to just simply look to give up or look to the quickest solution. Rather, I want to be the lawyer or the mediator that's providing just the right amount of what it is that that client needs. That's kind of the concept. And then I hired people to do colors and branding and whatnot, right? I don't know. It's one of those things where we developed the name and I was not sold on it, but I said, okay, we'll do this. We'll try it. And then the more that it's happened, the more that I've been like, oh yeah, that really is me. I'm really doing that. And now, at least I think for any good branding, it's like, okay, what are those core values? What would be the Lagom thing to do here, right? Yeah. What is the not too much, not too little approach that's probably going to get the result I want. So yeah, that's the, again, my wife, she's smarter than I am. I'm glad we have one set of brains in the family to make good decisions. So that's where it comes from.
I love that though, because I love that the mentality, and I love that now you can now, like, it's like your branding, but your branding is on point to your practice. And so it's, because sometimes you see, like, when some firms like rebrand, you're kind of like, I don't know. Like,
that's not what I think of you. Yeah.
Yeah. I know your firm, and those don't go together. And maybe they're trying to be interesting, but it seems like that really fits what you're doing. Your wife made a good choice. Tell her she's smart.
I will pass along the message, but she hears it enough from me. Yeah, it was definitely one of those scenarios where I was a late adopter. I was a late person to agree to the process, but since it started, it's definitely the right decision. So yeah, very cool.
Well, Jeff, we're pretty much out of time, but before we close up, and I could say we could probably keep laboring on about many, many things. I'm like, the time went by really fast.
For sure.
But knowing what you know now after starting off as a teacher, then going to law school, you know, starting off in insurance defense and then going plaintiffs and now opening up your own shop, like, what advice would you give yourself, young Jeff, knowing, you know, where you started and where you're standing?
To young me early in my career, I think I would say take more risks and be much more okay with failing. You're going to fail a lot. That goes for any attorney. You're going to lose a lot, fail a lot, make mistakes a lot. Be okay with them and be better because of them. Mm-hmm. And learn how to not make that same mistake again, and learn how to accept the next one that you do make, because it's going to come. That probably helps sleep on those early associate nights. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like great advice for like anyone. Like, it's great advice to like give to my own kids when they're sweating some of their stuff. You just got to learn from it.
Yeah. I think it goes back to that point that the trial attorney says, we're not as important as we think we are. These things are not as big as we think they are in those moments. Right. This too shall pass. So
yeah. Even when you have that pit in your stomach, I remember there was like a time early in my career, I think I woke up on like a Saturday or Sunday morning realizing I like forgot to do something. It was like that, you know, that pit in your stomach.
Yes. Oh, I know that. Yes. Yes.
And I remember like looking on the dockets and I was like, oh my God, like, did I miss this? And I missed this. It was something with it. I don't remember particularly what it was. I just remember that feeling of panic, and then realizing like, okay, this is not the end of the world. This can be fixed. It is not like, I mean, certainly there are things that could be very, very bad. It was not one of those things, but it was just that panic. But then that realization that, okay, I've identified the problem. Now I think I know how to fix the problem. And it is not the end of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So many of us as attorneys, that my observation, we have, I don't want to say it's anxiety. I don't know if it's scarcity mentality or what it is, but it's this feeling of like, there is a finite amount of goodwill. And if I screw anything up, I'm losing that goodwill from my partners, from my supervisors, from my associates, whoever it is. And the reality is, you make those screw ups and you say, hey, I made a screw up here. Here's what I think the fix is. Can you help me or whatever? Yeah. And it's amazing how many people come, you know, good people come through and say, figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know why? Because everyone makes mistakes. If you're saying you haven't made a mistake, you're lying. You are lying.
Yep.
Or you don't realize you made the mistake yet.
Yeah. I'm not sure which one is worse, but they're both pretty bad. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's the trial attorney that's never lost a case. Well, I guess you haven't been paying attention then.
Just like the politician who's never lost an election, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So one election for you then. Okay, good. Congrats. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed sitting down with you. I hope I filled some of your extroverted space for the day and you got some of that cup filled today. I feel it too. I describe myself as an introverted extrovert. I love to be with people, but I also love to be alone.
You need both. A lot of people need both. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
No, thank you very much, Megan, for having me on this. I didn't know exactly what to expect. I've never been on one of these before, and it's just a lot of fun. It's super easy to talk to you, and I hope something and what I shared is helpful to some of your listeners for sure.
Well, yeah. Let the listeners know where they can find you should they need a mediator or even just a, maybe someone needs something to, an idea to bounce off someone, to bounce off you for that matter. Let them know where to find you and they can reach out to you.
Yep. So I'm active on LinkedIn, my name, or you can find me as my law firm, Lagom Law, L-A-G-O-M Law. On the web, I'm just Lagom, lagom-law.com. There's a New Zealand, I think, Lagom Law. It's a family law. So I'm lagom-law.com. I practice in Minnesota and Wisconsin. So if anybody has any questions about Minnesota or Wisconsin stuff, please feel free to call me. And like I said, I've got a lot of different connections from some of the firms I've worked in. So if you have a question that isn't a civil question, chances are I probably know somebody that I can get you to answer your Wisconsin or Minnesota questions. So happy to help.
Oh, good. Well, thank you again so much. And for everyone listening today, if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Claims Never Sleep. You can find us on your favorite streaming platform as well as YouTube. Thank you.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.